In England, researchers claim they found a possible vaccine to prevent the hospital superbug called MRSA. They're working with a manufacturer to develop this shot, which will be given to patients and staff in hospitals. Around a quarter of the population in the United Kingdom carries the bug harmlessly in their noses. The team at Sheffield University found it produces more than 100 proteins during human infection. Medics are carrying out clinical tests on the material to see if hospital pajamas, for example, made from silver-type fabric, could ward off MRSA, which apparently kills up to 800 people a year in the United Kingdom. Vaccines, though, do they work? And what about the bird flu? Tonight, a special report with our guest, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is the director and founder of Osteomed 2, a clinic established to provide alternative, traditional, and preventative medicine. She's also the president of New Medical Awareness Seminars. She's a graduate of the University of Toledo, and she's received her medical training at Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine in Kirksville, Missouri. Dr. Tenpenny is a board certified in emergency medicine and osteopathic manipulative medicine. And she has lectured abroad on health issues at numerous conferences, conventions, and universities. She's also a regular guest on radio talk shows, including Coast to Coast. In addition, she's been published in numerous magazines, newspapers, and internet sites. Dr. Tenpenny is an alternative medicine researcher, highly sought after for her ability to present scientific information regarding vaccination hazards. Tonight, a very special program on Coast to Coast, because we really have never devoted the entire program to talking about vaccines and the bird flu specifically. We're going to do that tonight. Hello, Sherry. Welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, George. Thank you so much. I'm great. And how are you?
I'm doing fine. You know, some time ago when they were telling us about this impending pandemic of the bird flu, I went on the air, stuck my head in the old noose and said, folks, I just don't believe it. Now, I did that with intuitiveness, with my gut. I didn't do it with a lot of knowledge and information. Unfortunately, I just took the chance. Tell me I'm right, Sherry.
You're right. You're good. Absolutely right, George. This is a problem with birds. It's not a problem with humans, and I highly doubt that it's going to be a problem with humans on the massive scale that we are being told and we are being led to believe.
If it's a problem with humans, it's because of the, I think, insanity created by the CDC, where I saw 2 weeks ago they said that they are working in a laboratory that they say is safe with some researchers trying to mutate the bird flu to see how it would affect people. What if this gets loose?
Well, that's a good point, because I do think that there's certainly the potential for that. The world is being convinced that this H5N1 virus is going to mutate so it can spread to human to human. It hasn't done that so far, and as a matter of fact, I think that the populations of people that it has been seen in, it's found to be a very non-aggressive virus, George. For example, even in the new vaccine trials, they've had to use 12 times the dose of the virus in order to stimulate an antibody response similar to the antibody response that you see from just the regular garden variety influenza annual flu shot. So what that tells me is that the immune system looks at this virus and says, well, this isn't any big deal. And that is even backed up by research that's been done in China. In 1992, there was a huge study that was done that they surveyed thousands and thousands of poultry workers throughout China, found that they had already been exposed to the H5N1 virus and had an antibody for it and were not sick. They've also surveyed thousands of people in Southeast Asia that handle poultry and live with their chickens, and they have not been sick enough to go to the doctor, and they have a positive antibody to H5N1. So I think that this is really much more of a power grab for the pharmaceutical industry and the huge multinational poultry producers that are pushing forward their factory farmed agendas around the world.
I think as this program evolves tonight with you, Sherry, we will find out that there's something else going on here other than trying to prevent disease from afflicting all of us. There's money involved, big money involved, and also there's fear. I have a feeling that since 2001, governments have decided we've got to keep people on their toes. We've got to keep them scared. We've got to keep pounding them with this kind of junk. And I think that's what they're doing to us.
It's not only that, but they also have created a complete agenda for this. They have a plan in place to manipulate the public and put more fear in place, which I just found to be quite amazing. They've hired a couple of experts who are considered to be risk communication experts, and they've put together a 10-step plan. Have you read much about that,
Mark? I have not. Tell me about this.
Well, what this is, it's a 10-step plan that's been put together by risk communication experts, Dr. Peter Salmon and his psychiatrist wife, Dr. Jody Leonard. And what they have come up with is a 10-step plan to keep people in a fear-based place. So the second step of the plan is don't be afraid to frighten people, and we can't scare people enough about the H5N1. So these are the people that go around the country, all around the world, and try to tell people how to communicate this to people so that they know what's going on in the government. The third step is acknowledge uncertainty. The fourth step is to share dilemmas, to humanize the organization making these decisions. The fifth step, which I just find is really amazing, is give people something to do. Make a plan for catastrophic global business disruptions. Understand that this may be the worst thing the world's ever seen. People may be dropping over in the street. We maybe have opening graves. And to have cognitive emotional rehearsals, learning about H5N1 and thinking how bad the pandemic might be and how you might cope. Now, this has been written in multiple magazines. They've been going around the world talking to people about this. What comes to mind is these cognitive drills of people they're talking about is what we used to see in the 1950s film clips of children hiding underneath their school dresser or underneath their school desk because they're going to have nuclear war.
I was one of those kids, Sherry.
Yeah, well, I was too, George. You know, I actually remember that. And how much would that have actually done for us? But it gave us something to do. It gave us something to feel like we were preparing for this. And I think that's what's really interesting is that we keep going back to comparing what might happen in terms of a pandemic. We're comparing it to the 1918 global pandemic of the Spanish flu that we all have heard about so many times. That in and of itself, those numbers keep changing over and over again, depending on who you read, how many people actually died. And there was two other pandemics that nobody seems to mention, the 1957 global pandemic and the 1968 pandemic. And George, you and I are both old enough to remember that. And I don't think that we remember the world coming to a stop or people dropping over dead in the streets or us having all sorts of catastrophic things happening in our businesses. So there's a fear-based agenda here that goes far beyond anything that I've ever seen before.
And I want, as we talk about this tonight, Sherry, in your research with your book, Foul Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think, I want everybody to understand that there are a lot of tiered people who are researchers, scientists, biochemists, who are out there to really do a great job to help humanity. And I don't want everyone to think the fact that we're coming out very aggressively tonight to belittle those people who really think that they're doing a good job, who want to do a good job. Isn't that true?
I believe that's true. I believe that, well, I think that whenever I think about things just like that, George, I always think about Enron. Because to me, when the collapse of Enron came about, I thought this was going to be the most eye-opening experience across the world that anybody had ever seen. You know, that all of those people who worked for Enron that were just doing their job every day, going and doing a really good job with their customers and their clients, and going home and having a life. But it was the seven or eight rotten apples at the top that pulled down the entire thing.
And they were secure, and I'm talking about the rank and file, saying, my money's in a nice, safe pension. This is great. I'm enjoying life. And the whole bottom fell out.
And I think the same way I have the same sort of vision when I think about people from the public health department. I think that most of the people, the nurses and the people at your local public health department, really think they're doing a good job. I think that they really believe that this is true and they're really trying to do the very best they can. But you can't help but think it's the seven or eight rotten apples at the top. that are planning this fear-based agenda and moving the entire agenda forward. You know, George, many times, the several times I've been on Coast to Coast before, I've always tried to avoid kind of the whole concept of conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
But ever since I've put together, you know, spent all the time in
difficult.
The vaccine world, it's hard to stay out of there.
Absolutely. You know, when I started bringing in that aspect into Coast to Coast in the beginning, I took a lot of criticism from people who weren't used to that. But all you have to do is look at what's happening around this planet, and all of a sudden you begin to realize that a lot of this is very, very real. And of course, the difficult job when you talk about conspiracies, whether it's a 9/11 or JFK or medicine and vaccines, you have to try to do a thorough job with the people you can respect. You bring them to the table, and hopefully we've all done our homework where we can talk about these issues. But you're absolutely right, Sherry. You cannot not look at conspiracies anymore, because I've always said, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And with conspiracies now, generally there's something going on.
I think that what the difference is, George, at least in my mind of how I've sort of shifted a little bit with that, is conspiracies have a negative connotation for people. And you have this vision of a bunch of people sitting around in a dark room with a single light bulb over the table and a smoking stogies and plotting and planning and doing things very hidden from people, which I think is quite different than an agenda. And the agenda is out there hidden in plain sight for anybody who's willing to just go out and do the investigation and find it. And I'm really coming to believe that this is an agenda, that these things are being moved forward, they're being planned. You can read them clearly in the government documents and the World Health Organization documents. There's really not much that's hidden about it. You just have to connect the dots, and that's quite an agenda.
They tried to scare the heck out of us with SARS. That died away, and then they've come up with this new one here, the avian flu. And, you know, so far, how many people have died worldwide from this, we think? A little more than 100?
Yeah, and the first that I started hearing about this when I was doing the research for the book, and that was when a lot of the outbreaks were starting to happen in China, and there were 7 people reportedly died from the H5N1 virus, which there's 2 points about that. One is the current population in China is 1.2 billion. Why did 7 deaths even make the radar screen? The second thing is that the most common cause of death of people in China is from lung conditions such as from severe lung pollution, heavy smoking, and both adults and children, the most common cause of death is respiratory complications. So did these people really die of respiratory complications? And oh, by the way, since we're now looking for it, we found this H5N1 virus and we're blaming it on that. I just think that it's just an amazing bunch of agendas.
Well, though I think the 36,000 deaths that the CDC reports annually from the normal flu, if there is such a thing, and I think that's an inflated number. But let's just use that for lack of a better number right now, Sherry. Mm-hmm. Every year, the CDC says 36,000 Americans die from flu-related symptoms, and they get the flu, and they die. 36,000 people. Now, it's not disclosed as a pandemic or an epidemic or anything. They simply throw the facts out on their website. 36,000 Americans die every year from the flu. I got to tell you, if 5,000 Americans died from the avian flu or 100 Americans died from the avian flu, the CDC would have this all over their website. They'd be having news conferences around the country, and they'd be scaring the living daylights out of us.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't have said it better myself. That's absolutely right, George.
So you went to work and came up with this book called Fowl, Bird Flu. It's not what you think. What happened? Why did you begin to look into this?
Well, when they first started reporting all of things that were happening, of course, the first thing that I started thinking was, well, look at everything that's happening inside the pharmaceutical industry. They're being handed a blank slate, which came to fruition in December of last year, as you know, with the passage of that Frist Amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill. But before that, there was all of this hullabaloo going on about the vaccine world. And since I've spent the last 6 years of my life and more than 7,500 hours of my life at this point in time researching that industry, I'm always very suspect of what they're doing. So then I started thinking, well, why are so many of these chickens getting sick? And who stands to gain and who benefits from all the chickens being dead? Whose interests would be most served from the elimination of that, of all of the independent farmers in Southeast Asia and China and Turkey and all these places? And most importantly, why are all of these deaths seem to be clustered in Southeast Asia? What is really special about that? And then when I started researching into that area, I found out some really interesting things about the connection between what I think is the biggest thing that's causing all these outbreaks in the world is the connection between dioxins, environmental pollution, and persistent organic pollutants in Southeast Asia and around the world. Quite frankly, George, I think that this bird flu scenario is really an environmental crisis. It's not in any way, shape, or form a healthcare crisis.
You might be on to something there. And the fact that a couple of years ago the CDC said, and the World Health Organization said, this had a high likelihood of becoming a pandemic. Why would they say something like that on something at that time that maybe had 15 or 20 deaths worldwide?
It makes me really suspect because it makes you really wonder what they know that we don't know. And I really came to that conclusion in a big way. In the end of February, I was able to attend the National Bird Flu Summit in Washington, D.C. It was a two-day meeting. They really didn't say much at that meeting that you haven't already said on your show and that people haven't been able to read elsewhere. But the thing that came out in a really big way was when the World Health Organization expert, Dr. David Nabarro, kept saying during his speech, when the bird flu epidemic happens and when this outbreak occurs. And then he even stopped and said, hesitated and said, notice I didn't say if this occurs, I said when this occurs. And he repeated that a couple of times, which makes me wonder, what do they know that we don't know, number one? I mean, and number two, how can you predict a random event?
And
that's
sure,
what they're actually doing.
Let me tell you, as Americans, if we were really aware of the kinds of diseases that birds and poultry were dying of in farms, we'd be sick to our stomachs for the rest of our lives.
And we would not be real interested in eating factory farm poultry either.
No, we would not.
We would not.
No, that, I mean, that's true. I mean, these animals die from some disease that probably right now dwarfs the possibility of the bird flu, and people are probably eating some of these things.
The biggest thing that's happening, and particularly in Southeast Asia, is where they're, and all of these things that they've talked about, blaming the independent farmer with their few chickens that they have, the 10 to 20 chickens that they have to raise mostly for their family in terms of eggs. When the birds get older and they're about ready to die and they only eat them at a very marginal rate, they do have them somewhat for commerce. These birds are not the problem. Bird flu does not evolve into a highly pathogenic form from backyard poultry operations, where they're closely together. They have a genetic diversity from the indigenous farmers and how they bred over the years. They've crossbred. They breed openly. They're not factory farm raised. They're not genetically modified chickens that are happening in the factory farm vertically integrated farming program. I really think that the backyard farmer and the backyard poultry are victims of this whole conspiracy and this whole agenda to eliminate the backyard family farmer and to install industrial-grade integrated vertical farming that's been really the main cause of what's happening in Southeast Asia and China for developing this aggressive type of virus.
I read, and I thought it was preposterous, but now I believe it, that some scientists would like to develop, for example, cows without legs, and they would just keep them all in small little cubicles, hundreds of thousands of them without legs, so they wouldn't have to worry about land costs and pasturing and fertilizing. They merely would hook them up to some kind of a tube and grow them, almost like you would a plant.
That's disgusting. Very disgusting.
Stay with us. We've got much more to talk about because eventually this is going to affect you directly. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, I still get fast blasts and emails from people who want to buy tapes of programs, especially one like tonight. And we just don't sell tapes anymore. However, you know, you have StreamLink available to you where you can download and podcast and get everything else, and that's really a tremendous benefit. I know some people who just religiously can't wait to wake up in the morning, they listen to the show a little bit at night. Some of them have to work very early, but they wake up and there's the program waiting for them, already downloaded right there. They just take their little iPod and off they go. So that's what I'd recommend. It is, as a matter of fact, it is considerably cheaper than what the old tape prices used to be. So you might want to consider StreamLink, and you can get all that information on coasttocoastam.com. Sherry, tell us some of the steps you went through to connect some of the dots that the bird flu is an environmental issue, not a health care crisis.
Where I started with that, George, was looking at the clusters of outbreaks of humans and the clusters of outbreaks of influenza and H5N1 in Southeast Asia. And I thought, now, I wonder if there's anything to do, what that's all about. Well, then I found two maps, and one of the maps was showing the intensive aerial spraying that happened with Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. And I then found a map that showed the outbreaks of H5N1 in humans and in the bird flu outbreaks of, the H5N1 outbreaks in chickens. Then I took those two maps and I looked at them side by side, and they were about a 90% overlap. And I thought, man, now that is really fascinating. So then I said, well, I wonder if there's any connection between dioxin, and which is the most toxic form of dioxin in the world that was found in Agent Orange, the TCDD form of dioxin, mm-hmm. which, as an aside, dioxins is a family of chemicals, about 250 different kinds. But this is the most deadly one, and the one to which all other dioxins are compared in terms of toxicity, the TCDD. So I said, well, I wonder if that has anything relationship to do with influenza. So through many hours of intensely digging and research, I ran across a series of published articles in the American Journal of Environmental Toxicology that showed the connection between dioxin and influenza A. And what they had actually done was they had taken a group of mice and they had exposed them to as little as 10 parts per trillion of dioxin about a week to 10 days before they were exposed to garden variety influenza. And the combination of influenza A plus that tiny little bit of dioxin doubled the death rate amongst the experimental mice.
Holy cow. Does it kill your immune system? What does it do?
Well, it causes the combination of the two causes such an intense inflammatory response, and this whole thing that we've heard in the medical literature and the medical jargon about a cytokine storm, and it's what that is. It's a release of a bunch of proteins when an infection is occurring that act as little magnets to draw in all of the various white blood cells into the area of infection to try to eliminate the infection. And so the cytokine storm just doubles in intensity when there's a combination of dioxin and influenza A. Now, I want to put into perspective how little that 10 parts per trillion is. One part per trillion is the equivalent of putting one drop of dioxin in a boxcar in a train full of boxcars that have nothing but liquid in it, just a liquid train. Put one drop of dioxin in a train 6.2 miles long.
Oh, the whole thing?
The whole thing. That is what one parts per trillion actually is. In these mice, the 10 parts per trillion in the mice, it was noted by the investigators that this was the smallest amount of dioxin that had ever been seen in combination with influenza A to cause such an intense inflammatory response and such a high cytokine storm that it stumbled away from the sick cells in the lungs of these mice and also started to break down and destroy the healthy cells in the lungs of these mice. So the 10 parts per trillion in mice was about the equivalent of somewhere between around 400 to 500 parts per trillion in humans, you know, when you do the, you know, kilogram size and all that mm-hmm. stuff. So then I started saying, well, gosh, I wonder if there's any relationship to dioxin still being left around in Southeast Asia from Vietnam War. And then I found many other articles that I researched that showed that more than 30 years after the end of the Vietnam War, the effects of dioxin are still being seen in people being born with birth defects and things like that. There were studies that were done that took samples of foods that these Vietnamese people were eating, and they were finding that in the samples of foods, that the foods had somewhere between 300 and 400 parts per trillion, and this was a daily dose that these people were eating. Some of the soils in Southeast Asia had 800 to 900 parts per trillion, and around one particular lake around Saigon had 1 million parts per trillion, and we know that as little as 2 or 3 parts per trillion is enough to disrupt the immune system. So the people in Southeast Asia are getting daily doses from their environment. They're getting doses from their foods that are still eating and are highly contaminated. And then they're having an aggressive virus that happens to go in and causes this big inflammatory response. Now, we know from the research that there are certain viruses that cause stronger inflammatory responses than others. And this particular virus, this H5N1, seems to have a higher inflammatory response just intrinsically on its own. But I'm not so sure that that's even true, George, because some of the research that has been done in a laboratory that they have shown that this H5N1 causes this huge cytokine storm, I found that the research was done on lung tissue that was extracted from people from Hong Kong who were also experiencing lung cancer. So one of the presumptions is perhaps these people had a higher level of dioxin in the tissue sample that they used for the experiment, and so we're getting this false sense that, oh, this H5N1 is causing all this big inflammatory response, when it's really the combination of the influenza virus plus dioxin and other types of environmental pollutants that are causing these raging number of deaths. I started looking at, well, gosh, now we're not just in Southeast Asia anymore, and we're not having Agent Orange, and we're not spraying Southeast Asia. And we're having outbreaks in China and Eastern Turkey and Eastern Europe and now in Iraq. And so when you started looking at the background environmental toxicities that were going on in those very places where we are showing the quote-unquote outbreaks of H5N1, there is a huge amount of environmental contamination with persisting organic pollutants, with open sewage being poured by the tens of millions of tons, pesticides, organophosphates that are ending up in the water supply, and depleted uranium that's been happening because of the bombings that we've been doing. I really think that what's happening with these birds being sick and the migratory birds being sick is a huge environmental wake-up call saying that these influenza viruses have been around forever. Garden variety influenza viruses around all the time. We have a little bit higher aggressive virus that's now getting everybody's attention, and this is an environmental emergency, an environmental problem and catastrophe and a crisis, not really a healthcare one.
I remember from my days here in the St. Louis area that there was a guy who used to take oil, mix it in with dioxin, and he'd spray the roads around Times Beach, Missouri.
Wow.
They'd spray the roads with oil originally to keep the dust down, right? Mm-hmm. All these dirt roads. Well, he put dioxin in it too. Well, we lost the town. Times Beach was gone in all practical purposes. Everybody moved out. They scraped off layers of dirt all over the place and built incinerators to burn it off, and then they said the atmosphere was okay. I'm still not sure about that, but they've turned Times Beach into a park, and I've got to tell you, I still don't know, some 25 years later, what the incidence of cancer might be for those people who had lived there at the time when this guy was spraying dioxin on the roads all over the place.
That's exactly right. So what we need to be doing to solve this crisis is not creating vaccines, is not creating fear-based hysteria across the world, but we need to be enforcing the environmental laws that are on the books. In fact, it was in May of 2001, there was the first Stockholm Convention that was held in Argentina, that it was an environmental treaty that was signed to eliminate what the World Health Organization and the UN calls the Dirty Dozen, which are the 12 most toxic forms of environmental chemicals found in the world over an extended period of time. So far, they've got more than 90 countries that have signed on to this, and it actually went into effect in May of 2004. But from the best of what I can figure out, and I've been in contact with these people in Europe and the actual people who wrote the treaty, there's really no teeth in it. It's like a lot of environmental treaties or other types of treaties that we sign. It sounds very grandiose, and isn't it just wonderful that we're going to eliminate these chemicals, but nobody's doing anything about it.
You know, I thought like you, why do all these cases of human diseases always pop out in Asia? I mean, for a moment, I thought, is this area possibly the most unhygienic in the world? It just doesn't make sense.
It is. It very much is. There's tens of billions of tons of raw sewage that's being pumped into the water supply in China.
Oh, my
God. Know, like
the
high-rise hotels and things that are there. I mean, you flush the toilet and you think of it just like you would in an American hotel. It was going to go into the sewage treatment facility before it would get out into the water. Well, they have outbuilt their capacities of what little bit of sewage treatment facilities that they have, and raw sewage goes out of the pipes of the hotel right into the water supply. Raw sewage.
What are they drinking? Are they drinking bottled water, I hope, or are they drinking from there?
Well, no. What they have actually found in the rivers in China is that more than 30% of the rivers, like the two main rivers that are there, the Yellow River and the Yangtze, that in China, 40% of the water, of large stretches of water, the Yellow River has been classified unsuitable for human contact, irrigation, or agriculture.
It's almost like a dead river.
Yes. And that in the Yangtze River, more than 23.4 billion tons of sewage and industrial waste are dumped into that river every single year. So we've got all sorts of environmental things that are going on. In fact, the headwaters of the Yellow River and the Yangtze River come from a lake way up in the Tibetan Plain called Lake Kokonor. And that was the lake that was last summer. Remember when they had that very large outbreak of death of migratory birds? They had like several thousand migratory birds.
Right.
The Chinese name for it, I usually sort of mutilate it. I think it's Qing Chi or something like that. But the Tibetan name for it is called Lake Kokonor. When I started looking at why did suddenly all these migratory birds die, there were a couple things that came to mind from that. One is that when they landed in that lake, which is a huge bird preserve, it's about a 185,000 acre lake or something like that. It's a huge amount. More than 300,000 migratory birds annually go through there. That is the lake that's the headwater for more than 10 of the major rivers that go through Southeast Asia. So I thought, well, gosh, what's in that water? Well, as it turns out, that lake is a nuclear waste dump for the Chinese, since the 1950s, they have been doing experiments there, and since the 1980s, they have dumped, or I'm sorry, since the 1960s, they've been doing nuclear research there and dumping nuclear waste into the headwaters of that lake that goes into most of the world's more than 40% of the world's population gets its water that starts at the headwaters of that lake. Now, all of those birds had been summering down in Southeast Asia, which they were eating the pond scum and the little fish and all the little grasses that have these high concentrations of dioxin. Dioxin ends up into very high concentrations in the fat of these birds. When the birds start to migrate, then they're flying over long distances without eating. They are burning their body's fat. So they start releasing the dioxins and the chemicals from their own fat, and then they get exposed to some little virus, or they get exposed to a big dose of nuclear radiation in this lake, and they die.
Good point. Good work. Is anybody else following up on this?
I don't know. George, you know what my research is like and
sure.
How I compile all this and put it together and how I've done with all the vaccine stuff for all these years. And once I start connecting the dots and putting it together, I've gotten all this out of the research literature. In fact, the book that I wrote is 250 pages of text and 55 pages of footnotes that document all of this research that I put together.
Well, that's important, too. When you talk about these things, they're just not coming off the top of your head.
No, not at all. And many, many hours of intense research of putting these things and looking at that this is an environmental wake-up call. These birds are acting like canaries in the coal mine to us. The difference is that we can't just see the canaries drop over dead and run out and save our lives. I mean, what we're looking at is massive destruction of the poultry industry because of the way that the farm-raised chickens are being raised and the vertically integrated farming and the crushing confinement, the ammonia that these birds go through, the genetic modification. The stuff about the genetic modification of these chickens, George, is amazing. In the 1950s, it took about 84 days to raise a 5-pound chicken. Now it takes 45 days. And out of research from the Department of Agriculture in Arkansas, it said if humans grew as fast as genetically modified chickens, they would weigh 350 pounds by the time they were 2 years old. And if humans grew as fast as genetically modified chickens, they would weigh 1,500 pounds by the time they're 18 weeks of age.
And wait until they have the chickens without the feathers.
And wait until they have they are now in the process of developing genetically modified chickens to make them be resistant to these influenza viruses. It's coming out of Cambridge University in England, and the head researcher there has stated that once we have regulatory approval, we believe it will only take 4 or 5 years to breed enough chickens to replace the entire world population of chickens. That's what's coming.
Is there anything that science is doing that you would think is well intentioned and should be done?
Oh gosh, let me think about that.
Okay.
Maybe we can come back to that question.
We'll do that at the top of the hour. What about the swine flu scare of 76? What happened to that thing? What about the smallpox scare when we went ahead as a government and as a country and bought millions and millions of vials of vaccine? What happened to that?
The same thing that's happened here. You know, if you look back in history and you look at the swine flu affair and you look at what happened to the smallpox affair in 2001 and 2002, and that's when you and I first started talking about all the vaccine stuff, it's very similar. I mean, when I wrote up the whole section in the book about the recent fiascos, and I really actually looked at what happened with the swine flu affair. I mean, there was one case that happened on an isolated military base that all of a sudden we have massive passage of laws. We have money completely funneled into the pharmaceutical industry. We give them complete liability protection at that time for their product that they brought to market. And look what happened, nothing. The same sort of thing happened when we put this massive production of the smallpox vaccine. We were going to do all of these vaccines. We had all of these drills set up in all of these communities to how fast we could vaccinate these people. The pharmaceutical companies won again, huge big monies. Well, what's happened this time? The same thing, only it's ratcheted up even higher because now we've got billions of dollars. We have complete liability protection for any sort of faulty product that nobody is going to have any liability for. And now they've actually laid the groundwork through legislation to set up the possibility of mandatory vaccination.
I want to pass on, by the way, that Dr. Tenpenny has made available to you this deal. Here's a toll-free number, 866-325-8633. That's 866-325-8633. What she is doing is if you purchase two of her fowl books, two of them, that you will get the three-hour DVD called Vaccines, the Risks, Benefits, and Choices for free. She's doing that as a gift just for Coast to Coast listeners and only up to 48 hours after this interview ends. So if you're interested in that, if you purchase two fowl books, she's going to give you a three-hour DVD on vaccines for free. That number is 866-325-8633. Can they order online or just this toll-free number, Sherry?
No, they can absolutely order online, and the website is www.birdfluhype.com. Birdfluhype.com. They can go right there and order it directly.
Let's talk about vaccines when we come back and alternative medicine on Coast to Coast AM.